when it's curtains for the king.
A few hours ago, I discharged my last duty as king and emperor.
Britain's Edward VIII abdicated and then ran off with his girlfriend. Question, what happens in general to royalty after they leave the palace, lose their crowns, or are written out of the government? A guide to defunct royals scattered across the globe. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, May 29th, and we're talking about royals because today is a new day in Nepal where the royals are out and a democratically elected assembly is in. Also today, the fallout from a White House insider's tell-all book. And in South Africa, the government says it's not building refugee camps but protecting immigrants from becoming targets. That and all the news. Today, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice rejected allegations in former White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan's new memoir that the president used propaganda to make his case for going to war in Iraq. Current spokesperson Dana Perino says his decision to write the book is sad and puzzling. The book is already number one on Amazon. Same-sex couples in California, it might be time to start sending out those wedding invitations. Barring any last-minute challenges, California same-sex couples can marry starting June 17th, and those unions will be recognized in New York. Governor David Paterson has told state agencies not recognizing the marriages would violate New York's human rights law.
Big trade story in South Korea. 4-year ban on U.S. beef is over. Washington had threatened it wouldn't approve a huge free trade deal with South Korea unless the beef imports resumed. They'll start again next week.
A court martial gets underway today for a Marine lieutenant accused of helping cover up the killings of 24 Iraqi civilians in Haditha in 2005. First Lieutenant Andrew Grayson is the first of three defendants in the case to go to trial. In Dublin, more than 100 countries have agreed to ban cluster bombs. The controversial weapons have been blamed for killing hundreds of innocent civilians, often years after the conflict they were used had ended. Thomas Nash is a coordinator for the Cluster Munition Coalition.
It's an incredibly strong document because it will ban forever all cluster munitions. There's a very strong restrictive definition in here that doesn't allow for any cluster munitions to be ever used again.
Some of the countries that manufacture the bombs refused to sign, including the U.S., Russia, and China.
Bear Stearns about to vanish into history. A vote by shareholders today will officially make it part of J.P. Morgan Chase. The Asian markets, oil fell back towards $130 a barrel after closing in New York just above $131. Yesterday, we talked about adoption on The Takeaway, transracial adoptions. We wanted to know your stories, and here's one.
Hello, my name is Paul Rinaldi. I am an adopted parent of a multiracial child. I'm Caucasian, and we're also two fathers. So my partner is South American, is Colombian, and our son is Caucasian. Our daughter is of mixed race. She's 11, and there haven't been terrible issues, but I think that's because we've chosen to be very upfront with her about her racial heritage, and also to live in a community that's extremely diverse in terms of race and ethnicity and culture. So that's our experience. Thank you.
Thank you. That's a complex family. Anyway, today, what gets you out of your cars? What if public transit was free? How do you call?
877-8-MY-TAKE.
On The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. We're going to be talking about sustainability as it concerns a big corporation selling oil, and also on the neighborhood level. We're going to be discussing that later on in the show. And I wanted to tee up the takeaway question. We want to know what it's going to take for you to get out of your car and take public transit. There's some moves afoot to make public transit actually free. But we're going to talk politics. Scott McClellan has a new book out. It's a kind of poignant, warm series of reminiscences about working with President Bush. Not. We're about that in a moment. But are they rolling the credits in the Democratic nominating process? There's going to be a primary on Tuesday, South Dakota and Montana, Puerto Rico on Sunday. The Hillary Clinton camp may try to get the Florida and Michigan delegation seated on Saturday. But is it really almost over? And it seems like the November election campaign has begun. John McCain and Barack Obama are ignoring Hillary Clinton altogether. McCain is suggesting that Obama accompany him to Iraq. Well, Ben Smith covers the Democrats and covers all of politics for Politico.com. We want to talk to him about all of this. Ben, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, I want to just quickly ask you about this offer from John McCain to go over to Iraq with Barack Obama. Now, it's probably not going to happen, but you've been on the Straight Talk Express before, haven't you?
I have.
What do you think that briefing would be like with Barack sitting there and John McCain next to him?
Well, I mean, I think I'm not sure that they're going to fly that thing over to Iraq.
Yeah, probably not.
Not armored. But, I mean, you know, it would be John McCain's turf, I think, is the reason that McCain wanted to do it and then promptly followed Obama's demurral with a set of attacks on Obama for not having visited Iraq for a few years.
And that's really a November theme, John McCain trying to get Barack Obama on his turf. But let's talk about Hillary Clinton for a moment. Hillary Clinton's argument has boiled down to this. In the states where Democrats need to win in November, she claims she's doing better in the polls and doing better in the popular vote based on the nominating contests. And also, if Michigan and Florida are slighted by the convention, then the Democrats lose Michigan and Florida in the fall general election. How does she make that argument, and is it possible that that is true?
You know, she's not wrong about the polling, particularly in the two probably most important states, Florida and Ohio. She presently is doing better in the polls against John McCain than Obama is, particularly in Florida, where it's quite dramatic. He does better in some other states, notably Colorado, and some other wet New Mexico, some states out west where you could do Iowa, I guess, also where you kind of theoretically compensate. But certainly, you know, she's not wrong that she looks stronger in the traditional swing states. She's been making that argument for a long time, and it shows no signs of working on the superdelegates.
Ben, let me ask you about the Senator Clinton 11-page letter that was sent to party insiders. How was that seen? What's the perception of what she was saying in that letter and what it ultimately may or may not accomplish?
Well, it's the same thing she's been saying a long time with a little more data, some of it, oddly enough, provided by Karl Rove, which is just lots of polling, which she says shows that she's stronger, particularly in Florida, Ohio, Michigan, places like that. But it does not show any sign of swaying the superdelegates to come over to her side. I mean, what it will do is give her a chance to say, "I told you so" in November if John McCain wins.
Well, why aren't the superdelegates buying it if the polling is strong? Is that because they believe there's plenty of time between now and November, or they're just basically climbing on the train that's leaving the station? Barack Obama is it.
At this point, they are very much climbing on the train that's leaving the station. But, you know, they electability isn't the only thing they're thinking about. I mean, a lot of them have reasons to like Obama or dislike Clinton that don't have anything to do with who's more electable.
David Plouffe, Obama's campaign manager, definitely talking about the conductor of the train that's leaving the station.
At some point, we're the nominee, and at some point, and I think the folks in Florida and Michigan can speak to this, what they're interested in is stop arguing about this and start focusing on winning the general election.
It's over, as far as David's concerned, right, Ben?
He's actually been saying that since about February. So, you know.
but the thing that he isn't saying, though, or the thing that is new, is that he believes, and there's some truth to this in the reporting, that Michigan and Florida is now moot. They're going to award half the delegates. It's not going to affect the outcome. Poof, it's over. The Saturday meeting means nothing.
You know, it's pretty moot. Even if Hillary got everything she wanted, which is, would be to get them seated at their full strength, to pick up an edge of about 25 out of Florida, maybe like 80 out of Michigan, she's still way behind, and that's not going to happen.
So for the first time in the campaign, Ben, this week or next week, you can go to bed early and not wait for the results of the South Dakota primary, right, and the Montana primary.
I have have to admit I left for vacation the evening of the Kentucky primary.
I see.
Which was equally meaningless.
I see. Equally meaningless. Ben Smith, covering the meaningless primaries and the meaningful ones for Politico.com. Thanks for joining us.
They're all meaningful for the Democrats and as well as the Republicans. But today, for many Republicans, they're not focusing on the general election to come this year. They're focusing on former White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan. And he was talking this morning about his new memoir that has caused a big ruckus.
Before 9/11, when the administration was talking about Iraq, it was talked about as a problem that needed to be addressed. After 9/11, it was talked about a grave and gathering danger. And at the time, you get caught up in the White House bubble. You get caught up in your affection for the man you're serving. And you defer on a lot of those foreign policy issues that you're not familiar with at the time.
So you allowed for your own self-deception, then, is what you're saying?
I'm sorry?
You allowed for your own self-deception.
Oh, I think absolutely there's some of that that was at play as well.
That's Scott McClellan on the Today Show this morning. And the title of his book says a lot: What Happened Inside the Bush White House and Washington's Culture of Deception. And in that book, McClellan takes the administration to task over the Iraq War, its handling of the Katrina hurricane aftermath, among other things. The White House shot back, and they say he is a disgruntled employee. In his hometown of Austin, Texas, just like in Washington, D.C., the new book has gotten people talking. And Wayne Slater, a senior political writer for the Dallas Morning News and a longtime acquaintance of McClellan, he joins us now for more. And what's your immediate response, Wayne, to that soundbite we just heard from McClellan on the Today Show this morning?
You know, it really reinforces a conversation that I had with Scotty about a year ago, where he was really coming to terms with how dysfunctional Washington worked. It really continued to bother him, and I think that is reflected in that comment and reflected in the book. He doesn't like the permanent campaign. He doesn't really like the way the Bush administration has veered out of control.
And so what do you think his motive, while the White House is saying he's disgruntled, that they say the fact he wrote this book is sad and disappointed, that it's not the Scott that they knew, what motivated him to sit down and basically break this code of conduct of loyalty that President Bush has been known for?
Well, two things. One, he really is upset with Karl Rove in particular because he believes that Rove sent him out in the CIA leak case to lie to the press and to, in so doing, damage his own credibility. But the larger thing here is that, in an odd way, Scott believes he is still being loyal to George W. Bush, that what he is doing in this book, if you're a full reading, a more complete reading as we sit down with the thing over the next couple of weeks and people digest the entire book, is there's some good things about George Bush in this book as well as this critique. What Scott really has done here is said the people around him did not serve the president well. Moreover, he's almost like a son or a child in an intervention with a president, a parent, by saying, here are the things, even though I love you, even though I respect you, here are the things I think that you've done now that are so different than you did and acted in Austin, Texas, when you were successful as governor, that I think have contributed to the failures of your administration.
And this is an interesting relationship between McClellan and President Bush, because he was working for President Bush when he was then Governor Bush. And McClellan comes from a longtime active Republican family there in Texas. Let's take a quick listen to what the president had to say when news of what was in this book actually came out yesterday.
One of these days, he and I are going to be rocking on chairs in Texas talking about the good old days of his time as the press secretary. And I can assure you I will feel the same way then that I feel now, that I can say to Scott, job well done.
And Wayne, do you think that's actually going to be true? Because aren't there consequences, or haven't we certainly heard reports of consequences for breaking this code of a loyalty to the president?
You betcha there are consequences. Matthew Dowd, who was not as close an insider but broke confidence with the administration by criticizing it earlier, others who have criticized it have found it more difficult for them to get speaking engagements, to get contracts with business and corporate types and so forth. Let me tell you, when you break with the Bush family, with the Bush loyal circle, it's a real problem, and it's going to be a problem for Scotty.
But, Wayne, do you think the Bush administration has the ability to put people outside of every Borders and Barnes & Noble? Do you think to force down sales?
I think the book's going to sell pretty darn well. I don't know for how long. I suspect that it will, and Scott will have sort of his moment here. As a person, of course, I know the president pretty well, and Scott, I hope they both do well. But
thanks,
I'm
Wayne.
Not quite sure how long.
Wayne Slater, senior political writer, The Dallas Morning News. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Thursday, May 29th. We're going to back up for just a quick second. We had a nice discussion with Wayne Slater from the Dallas paper about Scott McClellan and his new memoir that is drawing lots of criticism from the White House. And I refer to a sound bite from President Bush talking about how he's hoping to spend a cozy time in retirement on rocking chairs with Scott McClellan. And I misspoke and said that that comment he made in the last couple of days, when in fact President Bush made that comment following McClellan's resigning.
Yeah, when he resigned.
When he resigned from the White House, that was back in 2006. No, not reacting to the book. So I wanted to clear that up. And right now we're going to move on to transit.
Do you drive instead of taking the subway?
Drive.
You drive? Yeah. What? If the subways were free, would you take the subway instead?
Yes, I would.
You would?
Yeah. Make it free.
So you actually enjoy sitting in traffic and
no,
in your car?
No, but it's faster. It's more reliable. I have more options. I can plug in my earplug and talk on the cell phone. I could listen to the news.
More options. How about you? Given the high gas prices, would you turn to public transportation and give up that luxury of defining your destiny? Or would you not? And that's the question we have for you. Drop us a line at 877-8-MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. What would it take to get you out of your car and onto public transportation?
Aside from an officer of the law.
You know. Yeah, but we're trying to stay within the confines of
yeah,
the law.
Let's
two Miami lawmakers, speaking of law, are betting that people in their city might want free rides. They've proposed eliminating transit fares and paying for it by a tax increase of half a penny. Doesn't sound like much, and environmentalists like the idea, but proponents are finding it a tough sell. Miami Public Radio Station, WLRN, and Miami Herald reporter Larry Lebowitz is with us. And Larry, why aren't they jumping at the chance there in Miami?
Well, it's a little more complicated here because it's really about the squandering of the first half-cent sales tax that they promised to expand the system with 5 years ago. And they have not delivered on most of those promises. And what they found was they promised way more than they could deliver, and they don't have enough money to do anything. And shockingly enough, part of the problem with these free ride experiments is when gas prices rise to $4 or $5 a gallon, they also do so for public transit agencies. More people want to ride, but then they would demand more service, and the agency's costs go way up as well. And if there's no money coming in from fares, how do you supplant that money?
So it is very complicated, but just very quickly, can you describe to us the 2002 deal that you were just spoke about briefly, the monorail? Now, that's actually free, isn't it, at the moment?
Well, yes, but that's only a small bit of the Miami-Dade public transportation system. It's a little downtown loop. That one went from a 25-cent fare to free. They also made the system free to everyone 65 and older. And what happened is the ridership went up 25-30% right away, but everyone that was riding it was suddenly riding it for free. Their revenue went down, and the half-cent sales tax that been promised the voters was supposed to be going out for all these capital projects. They couldn't afford the regular O&M on, operations and maintenance on the system.
So what you're describing is that people are skeptical that the government there can actually execute what they're promising, as opposed to being opposed to a half-cent tax in exchange for a potential free ride.
Yeah, you have to understand Florida and South Florida politics a little bit to understand that we do a lot of things on the cheap and promise things that we can't deliver all the time here, and then people get angry and then turn on folks. And I think this is one of those situations. It's hard to go ask people for an extra
cynical
tax right now when we've had really wild insurance rates, property tax hikes, and everything else that have gone on here. Florida is no longer the cheap place that everybody used to think it was.
Also here in the studio with us is Majora Carter, an environmental activist who founded a group called Sustainable South Bronx. And Majora, when you hear about a proposal like this, and there have been others, what are some of the benefits environmentally that might sell it to folks?
The same benefits that will sell it to an environmentalist are the same benefits that will sell it to the general public. If it works, if it's cheaper, and if it's functional. And what we just heard explained was that it was sort of like a self-fulfilling prophecy that it just wasn't going to happen. And so it makes all of us look bad if it's not functioning at a higher level. And that's the problem that I see happening right here.
Well, one of the interesting things that Larry did talk about there is that when you make the monorail free in Miami, ridership does go up. And then you get benefits from an instant boost in ridership of fewer cars on the road. And in a neighborhood like the South Bronx, what kinds of sort of free offerings of public transit, what sort of consequences would immediately bear on the neighborhoods economically for residents?
Again, if the transportation allowed you to get someplace you wanted to go, that would be great. But if it doesn't do that, then what's the point? I mean, the problem that I'm seeing is that there wasn't the kind of planning that was necessary in order to make it the kind of thing that people wanted to have around. And if you are, and I hear his point really clearly, if you're, you know, boosting ridership but not providing anything else, then again, and it's not really going anywhere, then it kind of makes everybody suffer on some level.
Well, looking at an interesting element here also, and that you ought to think about when you talk about this. This has been tried in other cities in the past. The 70s, there were some experiments with it in Denver, and it was tried in Austin, Texas in the late 80s.
And Stanton, New Jersey also.
Yeah, but those are probably the biggest cities that have tried it, and those are not, I mean, Denver is a big city. The problem is, back in those days, Denver did not have a rail system. It was a bus system, mm-hmm. and a lot of people tried it, and so a lot more people got on. The people who had been the core riders of that system already resented it, and a lot of kids, a lot of vagrants, and you run a real problem with vagrancy and homelessness on mm-hmm. these kinds of things, because if the system's free, you're not loitering.
And that's
you can
what
sit all day, and there is a problem with trying to police those things mm-hmm. and also to keep people who are the so-called choice riders. It's a wonderful euphemism, the choice rider, but to keep those choice riders on and happy is a hard thing to do. And politically, they turn. It's not just a financial problem.
So, Larry, from what you're describing, it doesn't seem likely that this proposal will gain much traction. Very quickly, do you think that's the case?
Well, we're still sort of counting heads. It's a little more complicated down here than just an environmental question, and it has a lot to do with election year politics and timing.
Mm-hmm.
And in Miami-Dade, the commission right now is looking at having to increase fares just to keep the system from running
pace.
Huge deficits. So they're sort of putting an election year tax on the plate and saying, here, you want fare increases or a tax increase and free rides for all?
Larry Lebowich, reporter for the Miami Herald and public radio station WLRN in Miami.
It really argues maybe for a much more radical approach where you overfund mass transit, massively increase the capacity as opposed to doing something incremental.
Why do you
and
think it's a
it
radical idea, though? What's wrong with trying to help people get to where they need to go, to work, to take care of their kids, to school,
I mean, if you doubled the capacity of mass transit, that would be a radical solution. And I think in part what Larry is saying, that works better than just little incremental things.
So we'll watch that story in Miami. We'll be back.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Mandy and Lester, a short film about a girl who loses two boxes of Scout cookies, a boy who finds those cookies, and who finds that returning them isn't going to be as simple as it seems. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. We're going to talk about an unintended or at least unexpected consequence of a $130 a barrel world. We're also talking about sustainability, radical proposals like free public transit. That's our takeaway question today. Would free public transit get you out of your car? What would get you out of your car? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Joining us here in the studio is Majora Carter, who is founder of Sustainable South Bronx. We'll talk about radical solutions to sustainability in communities like the South Bronx and all around the country in just a moment. But first, we have this for you.
Ladies and gentlemen, the story you are about to see is true. The names have been changed to protect the innocent.
Actually, we didn't change the names. Larry Finley is a detective who works out of Cold Spring, Kentucky.
There's no such thing as thrown away grease. It's all owned by someone, and that it's a valuable commodity, or they wouldn't be stealing it.
He's talking about grease. That's right, grease. Larry Finley is a grease detective on the trail of a rising wave of grease theft. People steal grease to use for fuel or to resell. In a time of high oil prices, grease for biodiesel fuel is hotter than ever. Chris Griffin is director of legal affairs for, you got it, Griffin Industries. It's an agribusiness that recycles used cooking oil. Chris, why would anyone want to steal your grease?
Well, much like Larry just said, you know, grease has a value, and really see it for two main uses. One, you've got the industry thief who will steal the grease and then turn around and sell it on the open market. He will either process the grease or sell it to a company that will process the grease. Then you have the other type of thief, which is generally your average citizen, somebody looking to use yellow grease as a feedstock for biodiesel in their home conversion kit.
And we're talking about, first of all, the rising price of biodiesel fuel and these kinds of oils that are your business. Tell me about the price rise there, and also tell me the tactics these thieves use.
Okay. When looking at the price increase, you know, we compete with corn, soybean, and some other food products. So as those prices increase, the price of yellow grease will also increase. And, you know, if anybody's been watching the news, you know what corn and soybean has done. So, yellow grease will move parallel with those prices in an upward increase. In terms of
actual number, hasn't it tripled from a year ago? It was 21 cents a gallon for the grease, and now it's 66 cents a gallon?
We typically tend to work off the yellow grease market in Chicago based upon poundage. If you look at the average price for yellow grease in 2006, I want to say the average price was right around 13 cents a pound. I haven't checked this week, but I know last week yellow grease was sitting at 32 cents a pound.
Wow. So what are the tactics of thieves stealing grease?
Well, you've typically got two ways that they'll operate. They're going to, you know, steal the product during the daylight hours, or they're going to use the guise of nighttime. During the daytime, typically fraud. They will tell a restaurant owner or management employee at the restaurant, company like Griffin Industries subcontracted this work out to me. I'm here to service the grease container. Most legitimate companies like Griffin Industries and other industry players perform their service with marked vehicles and uniformed employees, so we do not subcontract that work out.
Well, Chris, Larry Finley, the detective we referred to a moment ago, he's actually your employee. And he sounds like quite a character. And, you know, we talked with him yesterday, and he described, I mean, this is really serious crime, and you have to use serious investigative techniques to actually bring these culprits in. Here, listen to this.
We had a person who we caught stealing, and he agreed to wear a wire. And he went in to the buyer and advised the buyer that all of the grease on his truck had been stolen from our company. And the buyer purchased it anyway, so they were able to make a case on two people there.
Wow. That's serious investigative techniques there, Chris.
Well, when you look at the amount of theft that a company like Griffin experiences on an annual basis, you know, it is serious business.
So what's going to happen here? Are restaurants going to have, like, security pens for their grease? Are there going to have to be sort of lock valves on the tanks outside the back? I mean, are we getting to a point where grease is going to be as valuable as any other agricultural commodity?
Well, you know, the issue has several different implications. You know, from a restaurant's perspective, if a thief is coming in and stealing the grease, they don't care about how they leave the condition of the premises. So with grease, you know it's slippery. I mean, and they will leave this behind on the ground. They'll spill it trying to steal as much as they can in a short amount of time.
With grease, you know it's slippery. Chris Griffin, thank you very much for joining us. He's the Director of Legal Affairs at Griffin Industries, an agribusiness that recycles oil and animal products.
All right, thank you.
High prices create opportunities, slippery or not. But, Major Carter, we talked about grease prices skyrocketing there. Are there other sorts of opportunities that become business propositions in neighborhoods that you're concerned with in sustainability?
I would hope so. I even think that the yellow grease market is one. I mean, I think found it kind of interesting that these guys were building a market.
Yeah.
And we're afraid of competition.
It is interesting. Yeah, it's really
like,
interesting.
Guys, look, it's America. And that's what we should be trying to encourage.
Thanks, Majora. Now we go to Femi Okeh with the latest headlines.
At 21 minutes to the hour in California, gay marriages can start in 3 weeks, and they'll be recognized in New York, where the governor says it's a matter of human rights. It's the last day of Bear Stearns as shareholders vote to make it part of J.P. Morgan Chase. And in northwestern Iraq, at least 16 men are dead and 14 wounded in a suicide bomb attack. The bomber blew himself up today in a crowd of police recruits. The court case begins in California today for a Marine intelligence officer accused of helping to cover up the killing of 24 Iraqi civilians. First Lieutenant Andrew Grayson is charged with the obstruction of justice and making false statements. Hollywood Studios and the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists are working on a tentative 3-year deal. If the deal does go through, it will avert another costly television strike. Any sense of relief from the deal may be short-lived, though, for Hollywood studios, depending on how the Screen Actors Guild reacts to the AFTRA deal. They are also threatening to strike by the end of June. In international news, more than 100 countries have signed an agreement to ban cluster bombs. The treaty has not been signed by cluster bomb producers, including China, Russia, and the United States. And finally, do you remember this man?
Let me be clear. I am not gay. I never have been gay.
So Senator Craig?
Absolutely. That was really easy Trivial Pursuits question for you. He's about to write a book that will focus on his politics.
Is that the title?
Yeah.
The
State of Politics is the title. It will review his career as well.
As the incident in Minneapolis in a bathroom. That's what he was responding to.
When he was arrested last year. But that's not what the book is going to be about. It's going to be about his political career.
So who's going to buy it then?
I think it might be a hotter seller than the current one.
The McClellan? That's
think?
A high bar. That's a very high bar.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. Peter York, you're a columnist for The Independent, right?
I'm a columnist for The Independent.
Yeah, not many people know this, but I'm a king, and my government has kind of abolished me. Hold on a second. I need to find out what are my options.
Well, they're huge.
They're huge?
They're absolutely huge because, the residual value of fame, you know, you can play it for stuff. and now there is major media. Depends where you've been.
And if you're from Nepal, this is actually a story today. Nepal is abolishing its once revered monarchy. They're creating a republic in the Himalayas. The Maoists won last month's elections. Himalayas. They say that King Gyanendra and his family will have an honorable exit. But they're going to have to give up their money, their salary, their seven palaces are going to become museums. The queen has been forced to relinquish her stable of beauticians. What's the future for the Nepalese royals, Peter?
It's a bit difficult if you're what I call a small-time monarch. A big-time monarch, you can do anything because people are interested in your story. You can make a film about yourself. You can. They're all sorts of residual values of fame. But Nepal, as you say it in your country, is not all that interesting. If they've had it, you wonder, have they got a financial deal
right
in return for all this?
Well, let's think about Bulgaria's Simeon II. He retired from politics in 2005. King of Bulgaria, where's he now?
Now, I don't know, but it's, again, Bulgaria, it's quite a small-time thing to be. But the one thing you would have, because you're sort of European, is you will have connections with all sorts of other Europeans. There will be people to look after you. If you come from Nepal, there aren't that many people to look after you. In the same way that King Constantine of Greece now lives in England. And in a subtle way, I think the British royal family kind of look after him because he's got connections to Prince Philip, who is a Greek prince.
It's all about connections. And, of course, Romania's Michael I. He's in Switzerland and Romania. He loves to drive his BMW at high speeds. And King Fahd of Egypt lives in Switzerland. He must have some connections.
They all pitch up in Switzerland because Switzerland, well, it's mainly because of the tax situation and because if they've been sensible, they've stuck some money in there.
Peter, what about a musical career for the royals? Listen to this for a second. That's former king of Cambodia, Norodom Sihanouk. What do you think? Any precedent
there? It's weirdly compelling. Huh?
Weird.
There's a market for everything. It's not you and me, I don't think.
No, it's definitely not you and me. Seriously, I mean, if you're from a country like Bhutan or a place that actually where the royalty comes with a lot of money, can you have influence as a former king?
Not that much. Quite seriously, not that much. I mean, you can buy PR, you can buy a lobbying company in Washington if you've got a great deal of money, but what's the point? I mean, the game is up.
The game is up.
Yeah, the game
Indeed.
Is up.
The game is up. And the game is up for us. Peter York, columnist for The Independent, thanks for helping us with the guide to former royals. It's good to be king, whatever
it pays. Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. Join the conversation or give us your reaction at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Self-employed Eric Craig responded at mytake@thetakeaway.org. This is what will get him into public transit. Number one, a single ride once I get to the public transportation station, a seat, no crowding, clean stations, clean trains, very regular service, and a whole trip, a single reasonable fee, no extra charge for parking, bus, and whatever else. It'll never happen, says Eric.
He's a very specific, these very high standards.
High bar from Mr. Craig. Mr. Craig, no relationship to the senator from Idaho. Majora Carter is still with us. She creates sustainable solutions for communities in New York City. And here's a sustainability issue on a very big scale. Now, they may have started the world's largest oil company, but the Rockefellers don't have much clout anymore. This week in Dallas, ExxonMobil held its annual shareholder meeting in an effort by the great-grandchildren of John D. Rockefeller to make Exxon reduce its greenhouse gas emissions and embrace renewable energy was defeated big time. Activist shareholders say they will continue the fight. It was Sister Pat Daly who helped convince the Rockefeller family to take up the global warming cause. She was at the shareholder meeting this week representing her diocese and others, a total of 12 million shares. Sister Daly, thanks for joining us. Was this a real debate about climate at the Exxon meeting or just a stick in the eye for the Rockefeller family to butt out of company affairs?
Actually, I think it was a great win. And if I could offer here, when companies and shareholders, I should say, at annual meetings receive such amazing votes as over 30%, mm-hmm. or over 40% at a meeting where their shareholders are asking the board of directors to consider something, truly over 3% is a great win for shareholders. Mm-hmm. And because of that, and because these issues have been before the shareholders at ExxonMobil, that's really what has instigated the Rockefellers, not just beginning this year to raise their concerns publicly, but to really present this in a way that this is now not just about the company's resistance to look at alternatives, but it's a corporate governance. It's a real lack of governance, good governance, on behalf of the what should be an independent board of directors.
Well, how do you get Exxon to think about global warming when their business is actually selling carbon? I mean, that's what they do.
Well, what you do is you're asking an energy company, and they are calling themselves an energy company, how are you going to be profitable for your shareholders 20, 30, 40, 50 years from now? And it's not just a couple of religious groups here who have, and, you know, longtime shareholders from the Rockefellers who are asking these questions. These resolutions have been both proposed by and then supported by some of the largest pension funds in the world, such as the state of New Jersey, the state of Connecticut, Maine. I can go down a whole list, representing billions of dollars worth of shares. The resolution that I...
Well, hold on just a second, mm-hmm. Sister Pat. I want to ask Majora, what do you make of the initiative that Pat is talking about where you're using sort of capitalist clout to get corporations to change versus the kinds of neighborhood-level and street-level initiatives that you've done so well with?
Oh, as far as I'm concerned, this is a neighborhood
really?
Level. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
We've also participated in shareholder actions, actually, that with your colleagues at the Interfaith Center for Corporate Responsibility in my community with another project there. And so it is really important, and I think that 30% really was saying to folks, look, into the oil companies, and in our case, a sewage sludge pelletizing plant, that their shareholders are really interested in how their bottom line is going to be impacted in the future with the changing energy market, with the changing modes of everything and going forward in terms of this is a new economy that we're looking at, and global warming and all the other environmental issues are coming to the fore. So I think this is a huge step in the right direction.
Pat, you talked about corporate governance for a moment. Would your ultimate goal to be that Exxon, as part of its corporate mission, actually looks at non-oil fuels and getting out of the business of selling oil altogether?
Obviously, Exxon is... We're talking about the largest company in the world, the most profitable company on the history of the planet. We're asking the company, if you're going to be profitable, tell your shareholders how you're going to do that in the next few decades. And we've had similar resolutions before companies since 91 now, actually, asking them, you know, how are you going to profit in a risky, carbon-constrained world? And this year, specifically on this resolution that was also presented yesterday at Chevron and the Southern Company, next week it'll be at General Motors, we withdrew it at Ford because they said, you're right, we need to show our shareholders how we're going to pull this off.
Sister Pat Daly, thanks for joining us. She's a Dominican nun and executive director of the Tri-State Coalition for Responsible Investment. That's 40 Roman Catholic dioceses and congregations of women and men in the New York metropolitan area. Also, thanks to Majora Carter from Sustainable South Bronx for joining us.
And we're going to revisit a story that we've been reporting, and that is what's happening in South Africa. Right now, government officials are considering a state of emergency in the cities of Cape Town and Joburg in the aftermath of a burst of immigration violence. South Africa, we're talking, here are the numbers. 56 people dead, 650 people injured, and at least 80,000 people displaced. This is violence against immigrants who have fled from Zambia, Mozambique, and Botswana because of the troubles there. We're joined by the BBC's Africa editor, Martin Plaut, who's been covering the story. And Martin, welcome. The South African government, which has set up housing for some of these immigrants, says it's not creating a refugee camp. What is happening there?
Well, to be absolutely honest, the situation is extraordinarily confused. The government has been considering its options. Now, what happened today was that the Western Cape, that's the area around Cape Town, the provincial government asked for areas to be declared disaster areas. This would presumably give them greater powers in which to establish some kind of temporary shelters. The government at a national level is determined not to call it an emergency, not to call them refugee camps, but frankly, there are large tented areas where there are a lot of people who are seeking refuge. Well, to me, that sounds like a refugee camp.
And that's a huge disconnect between the local and the federal governments. Let's take a listen, though, from the perspective of some of the people who are living in makeshift tents.
There's no toilets, there's no dispensary, there's no clinic. So if you reach there, you find that even a dog, you can't keep it at that place.
That's a Tanzanian man describing living conditions after he's been run out of his home from. How would you describe the people who have been attacking these immigrants?
Well, what we're really seeing is poor on poor violence. You're seeing the poorest elements in South African society, most of whom are black, attacking other people who are poor, again, who most of whom are from the rest of Africa. And they're just, some of them, the people that are being driven out of their homes aren't even from outside of South Africa, but are from inside South Africa. This is just straightforward xenophobia, and the locals turn around and say, well, these people are taking our jobs, they're perverting our children, they are having sex with them, they're selling them drugs. They're particularly attacking Nigerians, who have a terrible reputation.
Actually quoting from some sound that you yourself got in the streets of South Africa. Let's just take a quick listen to that.
These people are stealing our jobs, our places, so we don't have a place to stay anymore, and you don't have jobs, They are taking everything from us, So we had to kick them out, And they are killing us, They are robbing us, and they're selling drugs, Nigerians, so we don't want them here.
They must go. I think they must go. That is the only solution. Because if they won't go, they're going to kill them, Even the police, I don't think they're going to stop this.
Those are some South Africans explaining why there have been attacks against immigrants. And all of this is happening, Martin, in the backdrop of a struggling economy where I think the unemployment rate is somewhere around 30% and in the midst of rising food prices. But yet and still, you say that the world should not be surprised by these tensions clash or exploding in this way because it's been simmering for some time.
Absolutely. There was a survey done by the Southern African Migration Project, conducted survey, which showed that South Africans were some of the most anti-foreigner people in the world. More than 20% of South Africans wanted all foreigners barred from entering the country. This compares with 13% in Britain, 11% in China, and 4% in the United States. So these kind of attitudes have been around for a long, long time. There have been a series of small-scale clashes. What's happened now is that it's exploded and become much wider.
Martin Plaut, BBC Africa editor. Thank you.
Martin had a story about how porous the border is in South Africa, that it is really, really open season in South Africa for immigration and migration. So that's exacerbated the problem as well. You can keep your responses coming to anything you heard on today's show, Africa, any other story. We're following the Saturday's Democratic Party intrigue. We're asking if public transit should be free.
And as always, you can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can send us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Got a podcast available on iTunes and on our website, thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Thank you. Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.